Welcome to Roots and Ruminants, your podcast for creative and innovative use of farm, pasture, and rangeland. We're going back to the basics of raising and grazing livestock, growing your own forage, and practical land use.
All right. Well, welcome back to another episode of Something New for our listeners. This is the first time that we're doing a shared podcast. And so Jared Nock and myself are bringing you the Roots and Ruminants podcast. But our special guest today is Jared Lumen from the Herd Quitter podcast. Yeah. And so we're going to have an awesome conversation that ties in both of our podcasts. We're going to go down some trails that do some introductions of things that we've done on our own operations, tell some stories about some guests that we've had, and do some high-level thinking of agriculture and how it's moving forward from a grazing perspective, tying in a lot of the things and the philosophies that Jared Lumen talks about on his podcast. So with that, we're going to go around, and Jared, why don't you, Jared Lumen, this is going to be fun, right? We got Jared Nock, Jared Lumen. We're going to do an introduction of the Herd Quitter podcast for those that you are listeners of the Roots and Ruminant podcast. If you haven't listened to it, you got to go check it out. Our podcasts are pretty similar, and so that's why this is going to work well.
So I think before we get into that, so we kind of went through this before. So Jared's middle initial is R. My initial middle initial is D. Justin, what's your middle initial? I forget.
W.
W. Okay.
Oh, we so are we got all J, J names even.
J, we got JD, JD, JW, and JR. So for this podcast only, I think that's how we will officially refer to ourselves as. Okay.
Because that's easier.
Not confusing at all.
Yeah. Not at all.
Two separate podcasts, three people, all with the first initial J, should be smooth. No concerns right here.
What could go wrong?
Yeah.
JR. Hour. JR, go ahead.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much, guys. I really appreciate you reaching out. This is. You guys, I don't remember now if it was the first or second podcast that somebody shared with me once. It was the farmer from Iowa who does a lot of different feedlot things. And I was like, these two, not only was the interview awesome, but these two are awesome. You guys work so well together. And so it's really cool to be here with you. I appreciate that opportunity. But my name is Jared Lumen, JR for today. I farm in Southeast Minnesota with my dad and my wife and his wife there. And I host the Herd Quitter podcast. A little bit about the podcast, I guess, to start. Like they mentioned, very similar conversations with farmers and ranchers around the country who are doing kind of mostly forage-based stuff, primarily cattle, but I'll get a lot of different sheep, and I've had bison, and I'm trying to think what else, but you
dairy,
know, stockers.
Goat.
I've had some dairy. Yep, goat production. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's
those
right.
Those have been my favorite.
Yeah. And it's fun too. I really enjoy those conversations. I wonder how much my audience does, but they keep getting good response. So it's cool to hear people, grazers just like hearing about grazers. And
have you ever had a camel grazer on?
I have not. Do you know one?
That's what we do.
Oh, but, you got one already lined up, don't you?
We had one. We've already released. We've
really?
Already released a camel grazing. Justin did, yeah.
Ah, that's awesome. Well, there's a point I heard some... Wasn't there some big craze for a short while on camel milk being like some superfood or something?
That's what it was.
Was
yeah.
It? Okay.
So she was from India.
Okay.
And she actually started one of the largest camel milk businesses.
Wow.
I think it's really good for infants.
Okay.
But yeah, we talked a lot about nomad grazing with camels and all the herding things about everything there.
That's kind of cool.
Unique.
I think to listen
Fred
to that
Provenza. One. Fred Provenza actually wrote the foreword for a book that she wrote about the nomadic camel grazing stuff. Yeah, who wrote Nourishment and The Art of Shepherding. So it kind of all ties together. She's in the community, the grazing community. Yep.
Cool. Well, I'll definitely have to check that out. That's awesome. That is one that I've not had yet is camel grazers. But it sounds like one I'll have to. Yeah, let's see. So just talk to farmers and ranchers doing cool things, primarily in a low input model, grazing based systems. Haven't had a lot, if any, really more of like the commodity kind of commercial feedlot program or type of a model. And it's not that I'm anti that. That's not maybe my interest and not where a lot of the people I connect with are operating. So I haven't done too much of that. And there's a lot of information out there on that already. But and then our farm, again, we farm in Southeast Minnesota. It's primarily a cow-calf business. We've got 230 roughly registered Red Angus cows. We raise bulls for Faro Cattle Company. We're a cooperative producer for them. And then we raise some crops as well. It's kind of funny. I grew up not wanting anything to do with the cattle, just wanting to sit in a tractor and farm. And now it's totally flipped. And if we could find a way to go 100% grass, 100% grazing, that would be the goal. We're just trying to figure out the way to make that work with all the, I guess, unique challenges and opportunities in our context here. So.
Did that flip once you got introduced to that side of it, or what made that?
So good question. It actually flipped when I bought cattle. I bought cattle not liking cattle, but I knew because of our farm's context, we've got a bunch of pasture ground that will really never be crops. And so I was like, we're going to have cattle. And I had the opportunity to buy some cooperative producer Hereford cattle from another Faro cooperative producer and kind of get my start in PCC. And so I bought some Herefords. And while I did not, over those years, gain a love of Herefords, I did gain a love of cattle. And now we're all 100% Red Angus again. But it was something about, you know, owning them, getting, you know, involved in the actual management of them and seeing what they can do for the land and the profitability potential. And, you know, all those things combined, I guess I really started to really enjoy it. And also probably partly too, I did that at the same time I came home. And prior to coming home from college, I would be home and do a lot of the work stuff. But when things broke down, it maybe wasn't my responsibility. And you know, when I came home full time and something broke, it wasn't just dad, come fix this. It was, well, you work here too. So, you know, figure it out. And all of a sudden the equipment wasn't quite as enjoyable when you have to be a little more responsible for it, maybe than just the hired kid home on the weekends and coming home in the summers and stuff like that. So the whole everything a little bit changed in that time period. So
as far as so you said you were able to get that cooperative herd of the Herefords and then transition over to the Red Angus.
Yeah.
And then explain, how did that relationship then start to build the Herd Quitter podcast?
Yeah. How that unfolded. My family has been a Faro Cattle Company cooperative producer for 15 to 20 years. I'm not sure when exactly my dad started with them, but I was coming home from college and I could have just had, you know, work with my dad and own the cows there. But for some reason, I thought it would be nice to start something of my own, start investing, not just buying what we already have. I always kind of had that perspective of like, I'd rather spend my life building and adding to what we have rather than just, you know, buying into what we already own and manage. So that opportunity came up. Faro Cattle Company was looking to kind of keep those Herefords within the program so that they didn't leave and we could keep Herefords in the PCC program. And I thought that would be a good opportunity to get started. And but as far as the podcast's connection, I always wanted to do a podcast ever since Clay Connery. He's kind of, a few of us jokingly call him like Brian, yeah, the pod father. You know, he's the original. He figured this stuff out before the rest of us. And he did such a good job. I remember when I first started finding out what podcasts even were, I just searched like cows, cattle, ranch, farm, and cows pulled up this Working Cows podcast. I was like, that's perfect. I really enjoyed those conversations. And I was like, I would love to do that. But I never got the confidence to do it until I actually started working for the Sustainable Farming Association, and they had a podcast, and I did a couple interviews with them, the Dirt Rich podcast, and realized, okay, I actually can hold a conversation for longer than 20 minutes. Let's, you know, this isn't maybe so hard, although I definitely had a lot to learn. And so I decided to go ahead and start it at that point. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Very neat. Very neat. Okay. So what's, how many episodes have you, are you into now, Jared? Do you have your countdown?
Yeah, I just released on Monday episode 157.
Okay.
Which, I'm awesome. So far to this day, I've not missed one Monday yet. I have accidentally put 10 a.m. instead of 1 a.m. So I did release one time 9 hours late. And, but other than that, I've not missed one yet, which I'm pretty excited about. And that included, editing one at the middle of the night on Sunday at the hospital when my wife and newborn child were sleeping. So I don't know if that's something to be proud of or not, but I got it out that week and haven't missed one yet. So.
That is
incredible dedication. Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah. Good for you, man.
And that's what everyone told me at the start. To start a podcast, you have to be consistent, get it out every week. People get used to, you know, I'm the same way. I know which ones release on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and I'm there, you know, downloading and playing it and stuff. And if that's what I'm doing, probably, maybe not everyone's quite as obsessed with podcasts as I am, but there's probably a few others who like that consistency too. So that's what I've tried to do.
That's great.
Yeah, you start to expect it as a listener, and so it is good to maintain that.
For sure. Yeah. No, it's fun.
That's great.
I don't know. I'm still. Do we want to keep going on that, or I'm curious to get this introduction on you folks too. I'm looking forward to my listeners knowing who you are. So maybe I'll kick it over to you, Justin. Tell me a little bit about yourself.
Okay. Yeah, you bet. So, I think we're all pretty darn similar. So this is pretty cool. I too have a herd of Red Angus cows. My wife and I run about 80 cows. Most of those are registered too, and kind of the same philosophies of what you're doing with the feral genetics there. It's a pretty low maintenance, docile herd that just does a lot of grazing on minimal inputs. And but then we also have a flock of sheep, and so we run about 250 Katahdin ewes. And with those same principles of they've got to work for us, and so those two we try to keep them just feeding themselves as long as we can throughout the year. We do an accelerated lambing program with them, so we're lambing in January, April, May, and September, each for 45-day increments. But from them too, that's a registered flock, and so we're trying to market some seed stock and find some value there with, selling quality replacements and rams. And then we have just a small little lamb meat business that we started, and that was the reason why we got in Katahdins actually. And so we still sell to one restaurant here in Brookings, and then to a few friends in the community that consistently buy one or two lambs every year too. So that's our operation, outside of the Millbourne side of things. And then with Millbourne, I've been here about close to 14 years here now, and have always had a focus on the agriculture side of our business with forages, cover crops, hay and pasture mixes. And really that's kind of what you said, your involvement on your operation and with your work and your job and tying this podcast together, there are just so many synergies, right? The people that you're talking to, you're relating to them, and it works both ways. I think I'm better at my professional job because of what I'm able to do at home, and I'm also able to get better because I can hear ideas and see people's operations and hear their stories and take their advice. Mm-hmm. And so I feel very, very fortunate there. So it's pretty cool.
It's pretty awesome to, I always think I get to talk to people I'd never have the opportunity to talk to if I didn't have something like this, a podcast. All of a sudden you have a little bit of credibility. So it's a pretty cool opportunity. But I'm curious. So you have both sheep and cattle. And I guess I'm curious what – seems like everybody, I know a lot of people who have gone down the sheep path and see all of a sudden there's a whole lot more profitability and choose to get out of the cattle altogether. How come, why is there still this balance, or what's the reasoning for having both and not focusing all in on one?
I think the easiest answer is that we're able to move cows away from our home site much easier.
Sure.
And not have to worry about predators and fencing. And so, our pastures that aren't on our home farm, that's where we move the cows, and the home pasture gets the sheep. And so
that makes sense.
I guess that's, there's been years where we found, the sheep have been much more profitable. This year it's going to be pretty darn close though. Calf prices are way up and lamb prices are just okay. And the sheep thing, there's still a lot more, there's just so much more variability, as far as, price stability and marketing options for them. And so I guess that is really why, the other reason why we're trying to market them is as seed stock, just to find that value and get away from the commodity as selling them as fat lambs. But,
Where are you primary marketing those as market animals?
Nearly all of our ewe lambs are being sold as replacements.
Oh, they are. Okay.
Yeah. And awesome. Most of them still go back into commercial flocks. But probably a third of them will go into registered stocks. And then, a third of the rams each year, that might be close to, I shouldn't say a third, probably 15 to 20% are being sold as rams.
Cool.
Another 50 to 60 are being sold as, direct to consumer lamb meat. And then the rest will. Those are the ones that do go to sale barn.
Awesome. And the cattle, are they registered stuff as well? Or are you selling primarily just commercial cattle?
Yeah, those we're just selling as commercial. Depending on the year, my dad still farms, and he too has a herd of cattle. And So depending on the year, we'll either market them together, sell them as feeder calves, developing them as heifers, or finishing the steers. And so I guess that really does just depend on where the markets are that year. So.
Yeah. And you mentioned wanting to graze kind of as late as possible, obviously trying to reduce your winter feed costs. What have you been able to accomplish and how are you doing that without, I suppose that could be a question that takes a whole conversation too, but
well,
maybe
it,
in 30 seconds.
Is, but, I mean, it, corn stalks are still our sure. cheapest feed resource by far.
Yeah.
And for both the sheep and the cows. But there too, you know, we tried to get the sheep out on the acres on our home farm. The sheep graze soybean stubble really well too. And so it seems like they'll go back and forth really well.
So I've been asked that question. I didn't know the answer. Sheep can graze and survive on corn stalks alone in winter grazing.
Bean stubble, yeah.
And bean stubble.
So it seems like they'll pick pods and beans off the ground way better than a cow will.
Huh.
And they'll spend about more time on the soybean stubble usually than the corn stalk.
And they're actually able to pick things like the shattered kernels off the ground, which the cattle can't. And so if you think about the difference between a cow and a sheep and how they eat, if you took a broken off little like 1-inch piece of wire or nail in a 5-gallon bucket of feed and threw it out to a pen of replacement heifers, that thing's gone, right? It's just a future hardware problem. If you do that in a sheep bunk, that nail is there 6 months later. They'll never pick it out, right? They don't slop things in. They very, very distinctly pick. That's why they can overgraze, right? If they're not rotated, way, way worse and be more damaging. But it's also an advantage because they can go out there and pick off individual soybeans, individual kernels of corn off the ground that a cow can.
So this might be getting off topic here, but will they be significant? Can you control selectivity with high stock density of sheep? Or will they just be super picky and kind of selective of how they want to graze if you're in some sort of a diverse forage?
They'll be pickier, but you can force them into it.
Yeah. Okay.
I'm answering Justin's question. Sorry. But I mean,
I was going to say the same thing. You're right. I think at a point they'll graze it, but be selective in how they go about grazing it.
Yeah.
They'll basically demolish any broadleaf. It's just how do you get them to eat the mature grasses?
Okay. Interesting. Cool. Yeah. No, I didn't know that they could graze like that. I didn't know if they needed higher quality feed than cattle or not, but they can make do on just corn and soybean stubble and without supplement, or do you have to supplement those when they're out there?
They're too, just like a cow. It kind of depends on what stage of production they're in. And so we've got a group that lambs in January, and typically we'll pull those off around Thanksgiving, you know, and start supplementing some protein and alfalfa.
Sure.
That April group, let them go and they're fine. Make them exercise, keep them out of the lots.
Sure.
But now, Justin, what if they were Suffolks?
Oh,
would you be able to do that?
Yeah. So no different than arrow genetics, right? Like we talk about the genetics affecting how their maintenance is and these Katahdins, I mean, they're just, that's what they are. They're a little bit smaller framed and, but they're thriftier. They're deep ribbed and
it's
can forage.
Got to be every 2 or 3 years I go through a real serious, like, I need to buy Katahdin sheep. I need to get into sheep. There's no reason. Look at the paper. Look at the numbers. It makes perfect sense. And then, I don't know, it's like, what do they say when you want to buy something, new car, give it 3 days and see if you still want to buy it. That's probably about the same with sheep. I'll give it a few days, think about it. And maybe I don't need sheep.
Yeah.
Maybe.
You kind of got to swallow your pride when you do it too.
Well, I don't know. It's like, I think I've shared this on my podcast, but when I went to a ranching for profit school a couple of years ago, there was a guy who's like, I don't want sheep, but let's walk through the numbers. And like after the ranching for profit school, you have the opportunity at night to kind of work with the instructors. And one of the instructors had sheep. And so he walked through like, I don't know, typical lambing rates, weaning weights, prices and stuff like that. And every number the guy gave this person, he's like, all right, you say you can wean 1.5. We're going to say we wean 1.2. You say they're 75 pounds. I don't know if these numbers are true. We're going to say they're 50 pounds at weaning. And, and at the end of the day, the gross margin still blew the cattle out of the water, even when he was super conservative. It's like, that's kind of, so I don't know. It's swallow your pride. It's like maybe a little bit, but it's like a lot of the numbers point towards that direction. It's just for whatever reason, we don't want to do it.
Well, I think the biggest advantage is just the low capital investment. And so yeah. if there's your starting point, right? Like if you're just coming into agriculture and you want to be able to start a grazing enterprise or a farm, ranch, whatever it is. I mean, pick the one that's going to cost the lowest and give you the biggest returns at the start. Yeah. And I think that's right. And you do see a lot of successful cattle operations that when they tell their history, they're like, well, dad started with sheep when he got going. And unfortunately, when I came along, we were all into cattle. But you hear a lot of those stories.
I would strongly recommend anybody that's first generation on a farm or ranch that's getting into grazing systems and learning to get sheep first, because your expenses will not be nearly as financially devastating as you're learning about, you know, lambing or what you need for protection and all that kind of stuff. Like, you're going to want to cut your teeth and make mistakes on sheep first, unless you're comfortable with cattle, and then get into cattle. Because, I mean, you get a set of $3,200 bred heifers or something like that in the next year or two, there is zero room for error.
Speaking of that, learning lessons, when I talked about buying into the Herefords, I bought in the fall of 2014. Talk about a great time to buy into the cattle business, right?
Together there. Yeah, we did that.
I got to it. I experienced a lot of very good learning lessons in those early years of being in the cattle business that I share now as a valuable tuition, you know, people call them tuition or whatever, that that I got to experience. And it was good. It's all good.
So that, I think that was the year that Spink Colony was selling out of their ewe flock, and they wanted $105 per head for their like running age solid mouth, you know, ewes to expose that were going to lamb in, you know, 5 months, right? Like the day turn, you could buy a package of ewes, a package of bucks and everything. So you could buy 32 or so, you know, 30 to 35 head of ewes for the price of one bred heifer.
I think they paid $2,400 a piece for open heifers. So it is what it is. I live and you learn, but it's all good. No, Jared, how about JD? How JD, about you?
Thanks, JR. And I appreciate the background on you, JW. It was great.
Yes.
So I'll talk just a little bit about our farm and the different things that we're involved with here. So we, my family, my folks still live on the home place, kind of over at home farm. My wife and I, we have about 25 or 30% ownership of the cow herd, contribute in that way with some acres and time and stuff to kind of, you know, to meet our share, but it's still, you know, my parents are still, you know, kind of the main operators of the farm. We also are partnered with them on a hog finishing unit and a sheep block that are kind of accessory to our cow-calf herd. And then about, you know, just under 1,000 acres of row crop farming in the operation. So I've been involved with that since we moved back, since I was in high school, obviously even before that. That's kind of the operation over there. And then recently I've also taken on, bought a little over a year and a half ago, bought half of the neighboring cow's herd. Which is about the same size of our folks' herd, about 200 some head. I bought half of his cow herd, and we're growing that to about a 250 head herd based on grass and things like that over the next year or two, through keeping replacements and buying a few bred heifers to kind of use up the grass that he's got in his operation. And in that situation, it's a little bit the opposite. So I'm somewhat of a financial investor, but I'm actually more so of the manager and operator. He still does a lot of crop farming and stays very busy, starting to do some traveling and that kind of stuff at his point in his life. And so it's like two separate cow herds. And we also have a separate sheep flock just because of another 75 or 80 ewes that are all Katahdins, all hair sheep over at our place. And then about 125 wooled sheep at mom and dad's. So it's a very, I would say, diversified in like 1,000 different, like 100 different ways type of an operation. So it's a diverse crop rotation. It's a diverse, you know, livestock. It's diverse. But I think that diversity is, you know, I was jumping in, right? And as Justin was going through stuff, because I was excited about the conversation to talk about what that diversity means. If you look back, the cattle and sheep markets, and this is additionally one of the reasons to not pick one or the other, but kind of be in both, have complemented each other, right? So for whatever reason, they're both affected by the same drought cycles, both in North America and in Australia and other parts of the world that are big exporting countries. But their life cycle is enough different. One, the sheep being much shorter, that they trough and peak at different times, right? So the same macro things are affecting the North American, Australian, South American, you know, kind of system that affect cattle prices, but it affects sheep prices in a different set of years. So usually they're the opposite. and Justin was talking about that swing, just in like the last 10 years, we've seen fat lambs as high as $225 a hundredweight and as low as $70 a hundredweight. And those two prices, I think, happen within 24 months of each other, right? Can't really think of any other commodity that I can think of that's experienced that percentage of a swing in a short amount of time. Nothing else is really even close. So it's really feast or famine. It works really, really well, or it just kind of like works okay. But it usually happens at different times. You know, when the sheep market is really high, the cattle market's kind of so-so, and then vice versa. So they complement each other well. One is a high reward to labor. One is a high reward to capital, essentially, right? So, or not a high reward, but a reward to capital. So if you've got the capital, you can invest in cows. They're a great store of wealth. Sheep are not a great store of wealth, right? Like, you can amass a sizable ranch. And then when you get done, you've got like this cow herd. And then like, that's your retirement income, right? If you had that cow herd paid off and you're running 400 or 500 head, you can sell those things off. And that's a heck of a nice fund. You get to, 800 to 1,000 ewes. Yeah, it's value, but you're not going to retire on it by any means. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of, what do you have more of at the time? Do you have more labor or do you have more capital? And then just diverting the investment both ways. But there, it's never, and this is, I'm always kind of the middle of the road guy, but it's never of which one's better. It's how do you get the right, of both, don't need to transition away from one or the other, but what's the right balance for you at the time on both?
Yeah, it's interesting because diversification, and I'm curious your thoughts on this. You made a fantastic argument for diversification. I always like the quote from Warren Buffett. He says diversification is a hedge against ignorance. And that being, in that we can't necessarily, his point in investing specifically in stocks is the context he uses that in for, is that, it's a protection against not knowing where the money is to be made. And, maybe that's a lot less relevant to an agricultural business where jumping in and out of enterprise is going to be pretty challenging. And mm-hmm. I don't know, I suppose, but it was a fantastic argument. Go ahead.
The last piece about the diversification I would say is not only, again, the sheep probably represent the highest percent margin return on capital, but it's the most exhausted from labor standpoint. So it's going to mean it's the most management, right? From a lot of different ways. The cattle are the best store of value, but they're also the lowest return. But they're also fairly low, relatively low labor compared to other things. Yeah. And then, like I mentioned, our hog barns, because, is that, everybody's like, well, how is that regenerative and things like that? It's like, well, in South Dakota, we export most of our corn and soybeans, a big bulk of it out of the state, right? Yeah. So is it more regenerative to feed that locally and apply those nutrients back onto our ground or to put it onto a 110 car shuttle loader and send it to Seattle, Washington and send it to China? Okay. Yeah. So there's gradients of regenerativeness and sustainability. Yeah. And it's certainly a better system than exporting your products 10,000 miles away.
100%.
So, represents a fantastic diversification from an income standpoint.
Yeah. And I like that you're doing these things on different resources for different pieces. It's not like by doing one, you're reducing your opportunity to do another. And in fact, by doing this hog barn, you're improving your ability to do your crop enterprise. And, they're complementary as opposed to just a pure diversification of spreading your risk of, you have this X land base, you're going to do more things on it rather than less things. You're going to do different things and utilizing mm-hmm. different resources that complement each other well. Makes a lot of sense.
From an income diversification, the hog barns have represented an integral piece of our operation since 1998 when we built them, right? And so we were one of the last folks, outdoor fairman hogs trying to sell, feed pigs and fat hogs at 10, 8 cents at the time. That wasn't working. Wow. This is a system that allows to keep the income generation that we were hoping to make from hogs at the time into a more real way. And we get paid every month on the same day, the same amount. And there, when you have so much variability in all the rest of our products, there's a beautiful thing about knowing what you have with certainty coming in. So again, it's a financial diversification on what do you have access from capital? Where do you invest it? What do you need from a cash flow standpoint? Where can you take more risks? We're able to take more risks with our other enterprises because we have one that essentially has zero risk.
Yeah. Yeah. People in the cattle business, we want to stay independent. Pork and poultry have all gone that way. But so many of my friends in my age coming home from college, the way they got back into agriculture was some sort of a custom barn. That's like the like you're saying, the lack of risk, that guaranteed contract that, you know, matches the length of the loan on the barn. I mean, it's a pretty incredible opportunity that is not available anywhere else in agriculture. So it absolutely
can use it as a springboard. Cool. Since 1998, when we built those barns, that is our hog operation is the only enterprise that hasn't grown. It's the exact same size because the barns are the same size as they were in 1998. Our cow herd has doubled. Our sheep flock didn't even exist until the early 2000s. Our row crop footprint has increased since then. So use it as a tool to get to where you want to be.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be where you end up.
So a question for you, based on all that diversification from a labor perspective, how do you manage? I mean, each one of those are going to require different skill sets and different knowledges, different talents that, you know, I can barely manage cattle and crops, let alone cattle and crops and all the different crops. I was just looking on your earlier. I was looking on your what do you call it now? Here, your introduction bio. Or whatever on the AgSpider website here.
Oh yeah,
there's cattle, sheep, hogs, corn, soybeans, wheat, oats, alfalfa, rye, cover crops. I mean, there's this mouthful of different enterprises that each one is going to require different skills, knowledges, and abilities, and equipment and stuff. I mean, how do you manage being able to be that diversified and do everyone effectively?
Well, that's a good point. I'm not sure because I've also really helped remedy the situation by having an investment in Dakota Vision Ag, which is a local retail business that got me started in a lot of these things. And then also my role is within AgSpire. And then, you know, it used to be with Millborn Seeds, now with AgSpire, helping to bring new business ideas forward and advance those businesses as well. So yeah, do definitely manage a lot of things. I have a fantastic support team around me at every one of those organizations. And no one of those am I the only person that can step in. There's a few of those things where, you know, I'm primarily responsible for some duties, but it does create a great big team and a lot of communication challenges to get it all done. But when it comes to like that, it sounds intimidating with all these different crops. But like when you're talking about forage crops, you basically plant things two ways. You're either going to drill it in or you're going to, you know, plant it. Okay. So it's only two pieces of equipment. And if you have two crops and need two different pieces of equipment, you now have the equipment that you might need to do almost everything else, as long as your drill is versatile enough.
Yeah.
When it comes to, you know, putting up those for forage, you know, we put up most of those crops for forage, right? So it's more just hey, we're using the same kind of equipment to hay or to chop those. It's just a, you know, different timing and different way and different goals what we're trying to produce from those things. But that was the biggest thing. I knew a couple of years ago as we were starting to do this diversity, we needed a, you know, a good drill. And I wish it was a bigger, but we just have a 15 foot Great Plains, but it's got a native seed box and it's got the small seed box up front for interseeding. Clovers and alfalfa and stuff like that into grass seeding. So it's got three different boxes. You can do everything we want. But man, if you get into any field bigger than about 75 acres, you're feeling way under horse from a bread standpoint. And you're like, you're going to be here forever and ever and ever. So, but I've got some family and some folks that I got an uncle that likes to sit in the tractor and plant stuff without a whole lot of GPS or fancy equipment that he'd be overwhelmed in the corn planting, right? But in there, he's really comfortable. So, got a great team that works around it. And I guess I'm fortunate that I really like to have a lot of things going on in my head at any given moment. And they are all interrelated. And I really enjoy understanding the interrelationships between a lot of different things. The things that I'm working on the farm help me to effectively do the work that I do with the ag retail business, Dakota Vision Ag, and also with an AgSpire and vice versa, back and forth. And so I always feel like, okay, if I was doing just AgSpire, I would have to spend like X amount of my time every day learning and understanding and getting to know the ag community to be able to effectively engage in it. And I just get to do that naturally as part of my day to day.
That's awesome. No. Well, yeah, it's pretty impressive to me. I know when I came home farm full time and over the years started working full time for SFA. A Sustainable Farming Association of Minnesota. My wife and I picked up a direct meat marketing business. We've done some real estate. We do podcasting and then the farm and everything. And very quickly find myself in burnout mode and needing already into like reduce the things, not keep adding, but you keep adding. So it's very impressive. It takes a very specific type of person to be able to manage all of those different things. That was the thing for me. Like I felt like I worked more hours when I was full-time on the farm. than when I had all those other things. But mm-hmm. I was more mentally drained by far when I was trying to remember and balance all of the different things on, that had to be done with all these different things, even though I was working less physically hard and maybe less hours. So it's interesting. Yeah.
I think that if you cast a vision of what your other organizations are, like in our case, like the people, we've been so fortunate over the last few years to be able to bring in incredible talent within AgSpire that are drawn to a specific vision. And then even locally here now, I'm starting to get kind of a set of neighbors that are, you know, kind of work on their farms and or high school kids that are really competent that are saying, this is interesting. I like what you're doing. We've seen you grow. We've seen how you're able to make a living here, you know, invest in the community. How can we learn from this that actually want to like seek you out and say, hey, if you cast a vision on something that's appealing to people, and just kind of cast a net out there, you'll find folks that want to be involved. And that's been key.
Yeah, I see that as a huge advantage to your skill set, Jared. It's like the ability to motivate others around you and then let them go, right? Like you can, what you're saying, cast a vision, lead that way, but mm-hmm. then give them the freedom to operate and make a lot of decisions within Dakota Vision Ag, even on your farm with mm-hmm. the people you're hiring. I mean, mm-hmm. high school kids, right? As far as the labor that they're doing. And I don't know if that is the answer to the question that you had, Jared, about not getting overwhelmed with things. But I do think I think in general, most farmers, ranchers, operators do believe that they have to control the work that's being done on their farm. And it's really hard to hire somebody and then step away and, you know, tell them what to do and be okay with them doing it. And it's, we do it just a little bit. We've got one college student that comes out a few days a week. And even there, I find myself doing things before he comes so that it's easier for him. It's like, why am I doing that? Yeah, we're trying to do it, but I'm definitely not there yet.
Yeah.
No, that I think you're right, though. That's one of the biggest challenges probably farmers have, is partly out of a unwillingness to give up control and, I don't know, some sort of a unfounded fear that they can't do it for some reason, that you're the only person that can do it as well or can do it right. And yeah, don't know where that stems from. But.
And usually they're the jobs that are the easiest to hire for. And mm-hmm. you can hire them cheaper than what your value is too.
Yes.
And so it's something that I think everybody does need to do a better job of just letting go of it, hire it out, have somebody come in and teach them.
So how much of the work that you enjoy doing do you get to do if you're finding yourself, primarily in management mode and delegation mode, or do you get to, maybe you don't want to be out pounding posts or sit in a tractor, but do you find yourself balanced well in that regard of what you want to do versus what you have to do?
Yeah. So there's two kinds of folks, I think, that, that kind of exist out there in operations. One that, I want to be the primary operator. If the combine's rolling, put me in the combine, and I want to see everybody else, you know, kind of work around me. And I want to kind of be in that seat to be able to call the shots. And then there's the folks that are like the handyman, you know, fix it type folks. They're like, put me in the piece that's moving around the most so I can see the most, you know, between the bin setup, you know, I mean, or like if you're hauling cattle, put me in the pickup and trailer so I can see that. And I think that I probably do a bit better in that like stationary kind of delegation mode for the most part, and being able to do things kind of over the phone versus adapt to the moving around a lot. So ideally, when in those situations, when we have like crews and stuff working, we've got like multitask stuff. I'm better off being able to be on the phone more than I am being the one that physically doing the stuff. So I prefer some of that delegation, as long as I'm not only delegating and I can at least have some rationale of I'm getting something done at the same time.
Cool.
Whereas others I know just kind of like to rove, you know, like let me be the fixer. Let me see what's broke down here and keep that moving over there. And as long as they could have 12 different tasks in the day and they're happy with it. Mm-hmm. So I guess it's my preference, but I feel pretty good about the balance for the most part, but
good. Yeah. One more question I had for you based on your story. You were talking about working with a neighbor now in their family, their farm. Is this like a retirement aid neighbor? How did you make that relationship? How are you working into that? I think there's a lot of people that want to find that kind of a scenario where they can expand with a neighbor somehow. And it's kind of a unique perspective of you're not buying them out, you're partnering with them. Mm-hmm. You want to talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I would say it's a unique position, but I would say that there would have been potentially some other opportunities for something similar. This is it's been like eight years, and I call it in the making, but it really wasn't my intention. But actually, they probably happened about 8 years ago. I think when their son got hurt in an accident, like a mechanical bull accident, and messed up his back really bad. And I just had reached out and said, "Hey, you guys are in a tough spot. Like, you need someone to come over and do chores. You can, you know, because I didn't have any other family, you know, right here and close that would be able to do that." And that was a big deal to him. And so at the time, I actually had somebody else that had offered right before me, kind of an older guy that kind of knew their operational bit, but they kind of had made sense to them. So we had engaged, and like I said, they're neighbors, we know them, in different conversations over the years. And then it was just about figuring out when the timing is right. And so about a year and a half ago, it was like, I wouldn't call them retirement age, because they both plan to be involved, but they wanted more flexibility to be able to like travel and see some things in the off season. You know, take a week or week and a half off a couple times a year, take a 6 week time off before planting season every year. Because when they come back, they farm quite a few crop acres. Again, they have pasture that shouldn't be broke. They know that. So it's like, okay, do we rent the pasture out? Do we not use these facilities and resources that we built up? Or do we kind of come at this a different way? And so then I can backfill that by saying, yep, there's another person around to, you know, move snow and things like that that have to happen when chores are going on, that just are kind of a byproduct of my being a part of the operation and then backfilling in the harvest and planting crew as well. So it just kind of came about organically. We had to figure out. They knew that I wasn't, you know, I was a busy enough guy. I wasn't going to work for a wage, right? I wasn't going to like come in and work for a wage, but they knew that I would be compelled by a business opportunity. So it's like, okay, let's put a shares agreement there that says values the labor that I'm putting in, either when I do it myself, or like I said, I've already got, you know, a high school person and then a part-time guy that come in back though when I'm gone. But it's my responsibility so that they know every morning that they wake up, someone else like is responsible. If they see something, hey, there's something out, or they're not quite liking this, or the cows are bellowing this morning, they might be a little bit hungrier. Maybe we need to up their feed a little bit because it was cold, something like that. They can notice that, but it's ultimately not their responsibility to take care of the cows. So it's a good fit. It's been good. We, like I said, we've been just sold off our first calf crop, and I think it's actually ran the numbers. We did our split. If anybody's interested, they can just send a direct message or email me, and I can help them walk through what that split was like. But I think we came to a very fair split on they have land, I've got labor, they've got certain equipment, I've got certain equipment. You know, I've got a small footprint of forage production, they've got a big one. How do we mesh those together and make it fair?
Cool. Yeah, appreciate that.
Yeah, and it's a good way because I can phase in. So in the first 3 years, I helped pay off what I bought in, which was half of the cow herds, half of the bulls, half the replacement heifers, everything 50-50 split. And then after 3 years, then it's like, okay, so now do I buy half of the machinery? Or as we upgrade, do I start the bale processor needs to get upgraded? Do we buy just half of that? What about the baler next year? And then all of a sudden, you know, we can phase it in rather than looking at one big lump sum buyout, which is just almost impossible to do. Okay.
Just seeing how, like, go ahead, Jared.
No, that was to say, that was kind of that rundown.
Yeah, I think it's interesting how even like on other episodes that you've done, Jared, on the Herd Quitter podcast, there's always conversation about, you know, transitions, you know, and mm-hmm. what that plan might look like and how people go about it and within family or outside of family. And now, once again, we had no intentions about talking about transitions, yeah. but here we are again. Right. It's such a huge part of agriculture, right? And
yeah.
I think obviously it's a big part of people and their legacy and what they want to do with their operation. But it's also a big part about how people have to get started just because of the capital cost.
It's probably a bias that I have towards the questions I ask, you know, because I'm in that younger generation trying to figure out how to get growing. So it probably more conversations lead that way than maybe should, because that's where I find my interest and a lot of my listeners too.
Fair.
You know, it's neat to see
that's a huge deal.
Demographics of the folks listening, and largely they're younger. You know, there's a lot of people of all ages, but there's a lot of younger people, and a lot of the response that I get from folks is asking, you know, these types of questions, or they're the, or people commenting, that was a really good conversation around this type of conversation. So yeah, it's cool thing about podcasts is I get to ask the questions that I'm a little selfishly wanting to know the answers to. And yeah, that's, so I appreciate you sharing that. Yeah. Sorry. I took over for a little bit there.
That's no, great. You bet. Sorry. It was taking so long, but yeah, I think it is.
That's good.
It's a good model and it works for me. And, you know, do you have risk exposure? You know, could I get screwed over? Yeah. I mean, could they? Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's why, you know, we had a couple years here where we had some real soft, you know, understandings and working together in different ways before we kind of dove into this, right? We really understood each other pretty well. So it was kind of a bit of a, you know, just kind of a get to know each other dance for a while. And we've had times where we've both been frustrated with each other over the last 15 months for different reasons. He's got a very high standard on how he likes to see his property taken care of, which I appreciate. Mm-hmm. And it's a good growth thing for me because I'm probably just a little bit careless sometimes when it comes to that. I'm way more, you know, function over form. And he likes to prides himself in a very kept up place. So I've had to learn a little bit. He's had to learn a little bit. We've both been flexible. It's worked out fantastic. So
cool.
Yeah.
One of the questions I'm wondering, Jared, you know, with we started going down this path about your cow herd and its involvement with ferrogenetics and that. Let's go down that path for just a little bit as far as you get into interview and have these people, these guests on your podcast that have the mentality that align with the philosophy of the Herd Quitter podcast. Can you talk more about that philosophy on your operation and what you've seen and what you like, or just relate that all together?
Yeah. Well, and I guess if you're speaking specific to the cow herd, most of the folks that I talk to, not even by design, I think it's probably just the people that I tend to be surrounded by. You know, you find yourself, you kind of look up and search and find yourself surrounded by people that align, but largely it seems to be people focusing less on production and more production per cow and more on improving profitability through reduction of cost and maximizing production per acre or production per unit of land. You know, we have a mindset of, and it's where are they focusing their, just what goals are they basing their decision-making processes around, I suppose. And I'm not sure if I'm answer this the best and stuff, but I mean, are we making our decisions based on, I've talked to people who say, you know, I want to maximize cow comfort and animal husbandry, like Will Harris. I just released the podcast on Monday and it was amazing. I was surprised to hear how much of the decisions that he made were based purely on animal husbandry. Like they don't castrate their bull calves, they sell bull meat. And it's like, that was not a decision based on meat quality. It wasn't a decision based necessarily on profitability. It was a decision based on animal husbandry and maximizing the quality of life for their given animals. And there's people who base their decisions for their production models based purely on, you know, weaning weight out of an assumption, probably that stems from an assumption that higher weaning weights might be higher profitability, but may oftentimes not result in that, but they base decisions based on that. So they feed in a certain way, they wean at a certain time, they calve at a certain time because of an overarching goal of trying to maximize weaning weight or production per animal. And the folks that I talk to and the goals that we have on our farm, probably I say it's out of a goal of trying to maximize profitability or production on a total farm, but I would say it's largely, you know, focus on profitability. And the way that we've found to do that is to focus on running these animals in as low a cost as way while still optimizing production. We're not going to completely eliminate production. We're not going to, you know, people have told Kit and myself that if you want to have the most optimal animal, go to sheep or go to rabbits. You know, you can always get smaller, but we have to provide something that's still marketable. And so we're potentially giving up some production on our land base because we have to have something that's still marketable. But our overarching goal is trying to focus on profitability. And we've found that we can do that by reducing our overheads, letting animals do the work for us. We're, like you talked about, the benefits of corn stocks. That is huge. That's like the thing that can even let us remotely compete in the upper Midwest with a cow-calf business, is because we have access to corn stocks that this year was a ridiculous year. Usually we're pulling them off around now because the snow and ice is too deep. And I figure if cows can walk over a fence on a frozen snowdrift, we shouldn't make them graze corn stalks through that snowdrift. But this year we're pulling them home about the same time because it's muddy and we don't want to mess up this no-till cornfield this guy's got. And so it's kind of a change of plans this year why we're pulling them home. But that corn stalks has brought us from being able to graze until the end of September, October, like most of our neighbors do, until the end of January and into February even. And that, along with the type of cow that has that allows us to do that and choosing a calving window that lines when they're, you know, dry and non-lactating mid-gestation cows with when they can be grazing on that is what's allowed us to build profitability. And a lot of the people that I talked to on the podcast, I would say, are the same way. The context might be different as opposed to corn stalks. It's stockpiled feed or whatever. But that's, I don't know if that answers your question at all or not.
It does answer the question. I think I like how you gave you know, the context of the people and their goals of what their operation is really, it is interesting to hear that not everybody is always focused on 100% maximum profit per cow, per acre, whatever it is. And, you know, I think that's very relatable to how we're talking with Jared, your businesses and your duties, right? Not everybody has to have complete control over every duty. And if your passion is moving poly wire in the summer from paddock to paddock and watching your cows come through the gate, well, yeah, that's what you're going to focus on because that's what you love to do. And I think that is a big part of agriculture in general. The passion that fuels people usually gives them direction in how they move their business forward. And you know, it may not always be in profitability or size or scale. It might be just animal husbandry, like you said too, with Will Harris. So it's kind of cool.
Yeah.
Makes you see it from a whole different viewpoint.
And I just was asked last week to speak at the North Central Highland Cattle Association, which was a cool opportunity. And afterwards, folks came up. I gave a talk on profitability, talking about things like cow type, calving window, calving season, grazing management, stuff like that. And they came up to me, and I think of the folks that came up and talked to me, the largest operation that what someone mentioned was 12 cows. And that, this is nothing against them. They were great producers, very thoughtful people, but the recurring concept was like, we're not necessarily doing this for profitability. That's a great point too. Is that part of the goal that people have? There's nothing wrong with choosing to do something out of a love or enjoyment of the business. And they had goals of producing this ideal type of cow for show ring or whatever the type that they were looking for was. And that was their goals and their outlook. You know, we're trying to make a living on 900 acres in a region where people told me growing up, you need 1,000 acres per family full time to farm. And we're two families and we have been three families operating off 600 acres. And, you know, we have to do that with a different focus and a different management style. So
they're also, I think there could be more research and education on the side of operations that are purely in it for the recreational point of agriculture, right? Mm-hmm. Like, how big is that market? And ultimately, they're usually sourcing, purchasing from people that are on it from the production side of agriculture, right? So you mentioned the Highland breeder with 12 head. I mean, you can see that in every species at every level of agriculture, not even just the livestock side, but just even the farming side, you can see that on. And yeah. I always wonder what impact does that really have? I mean, because it's a real industry, they're spending money within the industry of agriculture. And so they're making an impact.
Yeah.
Wonder how.
Well, and they came up, one of them asked me, you know, how do I, you know, kind of connect what you're talking about with what I'm doing. And I kind of, after thinking about that for a little bit, was kind of came to the realization, like, overhead is what the big thing that scale impacts. But there, it doesn't matter how, if you have one cow or if you have 100 cows or 1,000 cows, your direct cost per cow, your feed costs, your other supplements, things like that, you can reduce those pretty significantly at any scale. It's overheads that tend to get, you know, reduced when you have scale. Now, you might get some bulk discounts when you're buying things for more animals and some of those direct costs, but, you know, we can still make decisions at any scale to try and work towards improving our profitability as well. But
So I think it's important to note how, a lot of good business books and business management books out there right now are not focusing on trying to get people to understand how to be profitable with a business. They're getting people how to, it's like almost like more like how to win, right? Like, what does winning look like? Winning usually is profitable, but it's also something different because there's so many people that work in businesses, usually large businesses, where the strategy is to win at something, and that usually someone else is deciding that winning is the path to profitability, right? So you might be in a strategic initiative within a business that's going to position themselves from a market share capitalization standpoint that maybe doesn't directly relate to profitability today, but it's the key objective that you're going to be, you know, viewed by. That's where you need to win. So thinking about this, it's like, okay, and I know that we don't want to divorce profitability from that, but when you have producers saying that it's not about profitability, it's like, okay, then what does your win look like? And how do we get you to a win? Why are you in this and then get you to a win? And I think it is profitability, but from Will Harris's standpoint, he has, like many others, more profitability potential as a personality than as a producer, right? Gabe Brown is in this category as well. It's nothing against him, like props to him. Fantastic diversification of income. And so winning looks a little different because it might be a little bit more on the fringes and the edges because their education downstream might be more important from that. And then also thinking through Will, when he's like the highest level of GAP certification that Whole Foods has, right? So you're 4 or 5. He's at that level where you have on-farm processing to be eligible for it, right? So I mean, how many beef producers have the ability to have scalable on-farm products? Like almost none, right? So he's at a point where he can win nationally, maybe internationally, in animal welfare. So then all of his decisions to say, how do I win? I'm going to win by being the best in the world at this. And so then consequently, all the decisions drive towards that.
That's a really good point. Yeah. Because there's each step along the line, if you were to say, because I'm going to do this and continue to operate in the commodity market, you know, whatever may not have resulted in a win or increased profitability, but he made so many steps, so many decisions individually that would not necessarily have resulted in more profitability, but have led him to this whole new, he's white oak pastures, Will Harris, the product of humane animal care, you know, and land management, that now he can, as a whole operation, you know, operate at a profitability level that, you know, so many people wouldn't have. When you look at individual decisions that say your meat quality is bad, your production's more expensive, less efficient, but such and such is led towards more profitability. Yeah, it's really interesting. Yeah.
That's no different than you, Nock. Like, the most profitable piece about your whole operation might be the fact that through AgSpire and what you've done at Millborn Seeds is being able to stick on a hat, go to a Fortune 500 company, tell the story about what you're doing in a real life story about your operation. But the amount of profit potential because of that you have is extremely valuable too.
True.
And we might all have a little bit of that with us. Right?
I don't know if that's something you want to dive into a little more, because I'm intrigued by what that means for your business's profitability. If it's not something you want to share, fine. But
it's very fair. It's something that we're extremely proud of. Within AgSpire, I mean, we've always made a case that our programs really aim to connect those producers, like those that are listeners to our podcasts. And the positive practices that we're doing are vastly underappreciated by the companies that are asking for positive land use changes and positive sustainability activities on the ground. And the companies know it, right? But we have an untraceable food supply chain, right? There's not a great way to get those connected. And the goal of AgSpire, you know, its essence, and we do it in a couple different ways, but really is to make those connections and say, we want to make sure that as a producer doing positive land use practices or positive sustainability practices, they don't go unnoticed or unrewarded. They're rewarded, and this is exactly how. And the largest purchasers of beef in the country that have an untraceable supply chain that don't know how, and there's really no pathway for them to pay you a market incentive by buying your calves at the sale barn off your place, still want to reward you for the practices and then use that to capture a part of their story, to tell consumers about the positive things that are happening with beef, to negate the emissions that they are being ascribed to their beef production and all those things. So it's really impactful because they've been trying to make these connections for a while, but they just, their headquarters are in Chicago. It's hard to find producers there.
So in the question here, I don't know if this is, I love the idea of connecting producers to these companies. One of my personal frustrations with some certification and verification programs is like, they're coming in, they have very little risk and very, I shouldn't say this because I've not been involved with them, but they don't have any production risk. They're coming in and they're getting paid to certify or verify a certain program. They don't have any market risk. They're not buying the product. They're not trying to build the market for it. They're getting compensated just to provide some sort of a stamp that then allows you to go and build your own market and stuff. Where I'd love if what I'm hearing you say is you want to actually connect these two people where, and I think that's what's desperately needed, because to expect farmer A to be able to connect with CEO X or whatever of this company and actually somehow market their product at a premium, it's not going to be realistic. There needs to be some sort of an intermediary. And I'm not sure if it's the certification verification companies or if it's like Organic Valley is a cooperative that took on that very real market risk and bought the product. They needed that verification. So there's an importance to that piece. I don't want to completely just, rule it out as ridiculous, but somehow there needs to be somebody making those connections and stuff. Well, and I get frustrated with.
So when it came to like premiums that we're used to in the past, like NHTC or, antibiotic free, that kind of stuff, that's a certification that was needed for that consumer to ascribe any value to the product, right? Mm-hmm. They weren't just going to say, hey, I'm going to buy your product because you told me a story that you've overall reduced, hormone usage in your cattle. I want to know if this doesn't happen. Yeah. But when it comes to like this environmental outcomes piece of it, it really is about the brand being able to position themselves and saying, we're a premier brand, whether it's a restaurant or it's a retailer or it's a supply, it's a label at a grocery store. And you buy from us because you expect us to be a leader. And here's how we're taking this leadership. Because you can't have most of the supply chain or most of the beef producers in this country, getting involved in a value added type program that rewards them directly and buys their product, and 575,000 beef producers. Like, you don't get that, right? Like, the large integrators that have potloads of certain classes of cattle, steers and heifers every year for sale, if you got 2,500 cows, it's pretty easy to get someone's attention because you can class things up and meet their supply chain needs. If you have 150, 25, 5, it's really not happening, right? Like, you're not going to, the supply chain is not going to go out and get those types of producers put together. So I think there's a tremendous value to the fact that we have a disaggregated, decentralized source of food and cow-calf production. I think it's fantastic, but it also means that it's very, very hard to integrate, which is a positive thing. So this idea of mass balance, which is to say, okay, what if instead a large company said, we want to sponsor 300 ranches in the Northern Great Plains, and we want to reward them directly for what they're doing. Although we know that we're not going to try and trace a product through the supply chain, but we still want to take advantage of that. And we want to associate it not within a carbon offset program or not sell credits outside of agriculture, but to actually put that back to the consumers and their ultimate buyers to say, these are the positive things that are going on within beef, staying within beef. That's the kind of projects. I mean, we've got several examples of projects right now that are off the ground. So if you can go to Sustain Ag Network or the AgSpire website and get you a Sustain Ag Network, and then you can find out if some of these things are right for you. So, but yeah, there's an excitement from the larger companies to get started. They've just been waiting for the right way to do it.
Yeah.
So anyway, but yeah, it all ties together, right? Like I said, Justin, it is a value add, and there's credibility from the different ways I'm intersecting within this in the background for sure. And
yeah,
no doubt about it. That's a good thing. I'm glad that they're starting to, engage farmers and ranchers on what the solutions are rather than just, thought leaders from NGOs and things like that.
Don't you feel like, and Jared Lumen, I want to hear your thoughts on this too. I mean, we're almost at this pivoting point where as producers in agriculture, we were really at the mercy of our buyers, right? Of telling what our product is worth and basically just we needed them in this whole supply chain for us, right? And I'm not saying we still don't need them, but we are starting to pivot. That table is starting to turn just a little bit more where I see landowners having a lot more just a lot more pull in the whole chain because they are at the epicenter of what is now needed for this next movement of agriculture. If we're talking about carbon and regeneration of land and resources and really, I think it all starts there. do you see that? Do you think that's true, both of you, or am I living in a fairy tale? Not quite yet. Shaking your head, dude.
I think it's true. I think we're getting there, but I'm curious to see what JR says.
Well, as far as landowners being invested in the management of their land at a little more level or something, was that kind of roughly the question, or did
I just think, like, as we see this, is based off of, you know, the whole carbon movement and agriculture mm-hmm. right now. None of it can move forward without change of quality of land. And so whoever is the controller of the land is really holding the power of what comes next for carbon offsets, insets, and these business actually making change to their claims.
Fair. For a good chunk of it. Yeah. For the removals based practices. That's correct. I think it's true. But I mean, look at I could say the flip side too, and say you could have a very interested landowner that doesn't have tenants that want to make any changes that can't do anything either. Right. And so the owner operators and obviously complete control there can change and has the authority to change. In one situation, though, the landowner that has a tenant that doesn't want to do anything different doesn't have any value add because they can't switch tenants, or maybe they don't have another option there. I think there's a great part of the world that doesn't have that many options that is going to have less and less options on who's going to rent their land in the future. If you look at North Central South Dakota and you have some smaller tracts of land, you're not going to have 12 to 15 people jumping in to rent a quarter. You might be down to effectively 4 to 6 farms per county. Some of them kind of stay out of each other's backyard, that kind of stuff. You might have 1 or 2 options. You may not make them mad. So I think there's a trade-off there. But.
And yeah. Well, and the one on the renting, maybe it's different out in South Dakota. I've been some places where it's pretty vast. Maybe there's not that many producers, but I can't think of a place in Minnesota that I probably couldn't come up with somebody who manages in a regenerative kind of way that wouldn't jump at an opportunity to take on some more land. Like, you know, landowners do have to probably be willing to, we've been renting to you for 15 years, but if you're not willing to change your management program based on what I've learned and what I'd like to, how I'd like to see my land managed, then I might need to look somewhere else and connect with a soil health coalition to line me up with a farmer to manage it in the way that I want. Maybe that's not realistic thinking in across the country, but I think there's more and more people out there doing this kind of management that you could always find somebody, but the landowners that actually run their own land, they are the ones that are going to have to make the decision to change. But what's the incentive structure to do that? Is there a risk that they're going to have to take on, pretty significant risk to change their management system as they get more and more scaled? Is that barrier to change even higher and more difficult? You know, if I'm talking about switching over 200 acres and it's not my main income, and I, you know, worst case scenario, I back 10% on yield, and it's not going to break the bank if I'm doing this on 10,000 acres either. And I want to try it on 200 acres. That seems like a real pain in the butt to try and mess around with 200 acres when I'm trying to run all this, or to scale it across 10,000 acres is not going to be realistic probably in year one, too. So it's like, how do we make the incentive structure so great that it's like, we have to figure out how to do this, either try it year one or scale it. We got to do this. I don't know. I don't know what that looks like.
I think we're there.
Okay.
I shouldn't say there. I think we're getting there.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think we're getting there too. And I think that the land return scenario, I think they're getting people that if you own land at this point or a modest amount of land, there's still a very good chance that you could be a fixed income, farm widow living in a nursing home in a small town, South Dakota, Minnesota. But there's an equal chance that you're an affluent, self-made, doing just fine without the inheritance, baby boomer living in California. And I think those two have very different expectations and visions of what they want to see out of that land, right? So instead of maybe maximum profit, it's much more about, they're just playing up at the top of Maslow's hierarchy of needs, right? And they're up into self-actualization. They want to be able to tell the folks that they're going golfing with and they're going to supper clubs and stuff with down there that all the good things that they're happening in their land. And you're seeing some of that. I know some of that. I've heard of that.
Yeah. I've had calls when I worked more for full time for the Sustainable Farming Association. I probably had half a dozen or more calls from people. You know, I live in California, literally, or I live in the Twin Cities, you know, very metro, but I just inherited this farm. Can you connect me with somebody who can manage it in this way? I love what I'm reading, what I'm learning. I want to see it managed that way. And I'm like, yeah, this is good. This is exciting. Now, that's still such a small scale. I mean,
it
tens
is
or hundreds of millions of acres of farmland. And, you know, I've got somebody calling me about their 80 or their 40, I mean, and six people. It's like, yeah, we're a long ways from scaling this, but the interest is happening. And like you said, I mean, this Maslow's hierarchy of needs and stuff, it seems like the whole, not the whole country, but the land owning class of people are starting to get to the point where they can, they're more concerned with things of that than basic sustenance, that they're not just concerned with top dollar returns on an asset.
It's a great experiment is the fact that the average teenager, not the average, but a big bulk of teenagers in this country are 14 to 15 years old and are now playing in the top level of Maslow's hierarchy of needs, because all of their basic needs are met. They have no wants. They're not expecting anything from them. They expect love. They expect trust. They expect the care while they're around them. And they're mostly getting it. And then now they can be 14 years old and now just be like, well, all I have to do with my life is tell everybody else how to live it. So,
yeah. What is that result in? That's going to be interesting.
All right. Anyway, Justin, J-Dub, you're scowling there.
Yeah. It's kind of a sad thought. I don't like it.
So JR, you had a really good idea on how we could do, you know, what we normally do within Grits and Remnants, which is a graze it, rent to harvest it. JR, yeah. You had a great day. A way that you would like to ask a question back to us that we could all participate in a bit more of an expanded kind of a way of that.
Yeah. Conversation. Well, I really like your guys' graze it, rent it, harvest it, or whatever those three things were. Mm-hmm. That was a pretty clever idea. But I was thinking about when I have you on my podcast here, how do I engage in a conversation with multiple people with multiple different backgrounds and multiple farms? And clearly we found that's not going to be that challenging. There's plenty to talk about. But that being said, I'll still ask you the question that I had thought. And that was this, it's going to be roughly a scenario to start. And I want to just get your first thought reactions, and then we'll dive into maybe why you picked the ones that you did. But if each of you are given, or you're talking to somebody who's got, say, 500 acres, it can be whatever size of tillable ground, and they want to run a profitable forage-based grazing business, you know, sheep, stockers, cattle, whatever. I'd be curious to hear your perspectives on what you would seed that down with, because you guys are forage experts. There's, you know, native perennials, there's kind of improved perennial species, there's annuals, warm, cool season annuals. And so I'm going to try and stall here just a moment to give you a little bit of time to think about what you would do, because that's a big question. You have this 500 acres. It can be all one. It can be a split up of a different ratio of different things. But I'll let whoever thinks they're ready to tackle that question start off with what would you do? And just to make it a little more complex, because I'm curious, what enterprise would you run on it, or mix of enterprises?
Okay. All right. So I'm going to start by saying that whatever, you know, as I start to talk through this, whatever the answer is, it's never going to be a single enterprise, and it's never going to be a single solution across all the acres. And I think this is, you know, Justin, you know, we've talked about this before, you know, you say this in your own words, if you agree, but a lot of folks will want to come to us with like a big opportunity and say, I want a singular solution, right? Mm-hmm. So like in unexpected, right? So like in prevent plant days, be like, oh, I'm going to have 1,000 acres of prevent plant. What one thing should I plant on a 1,000 acres, right? Or rotation thing, or, you know, hey, I've got this, I'm going to rent this new ground. What one thing I should do? And the right answer, usually, almost always, should be, you're never going to know enough exactly how the cards are going to play out. You should never put all of your eggs in one basket, especially when it's like around a forage supply, which, you know, has differing needs from year to year, for both from a quantity, from how it's going to get put up, to like what nutritional needs are and everything like that. It's almost always seems to be a blend. So I'm going to say whatever as we get into it, it's going to be a mix of perennials and annuals. It's going to be a mix of enterprises. But yeah, I'll kick it over to Justin and then I'll crack at it.
Yeah, I think we're seeing it the same way. I mean, if you could start with a clean slate and choose where your perennials are going, I'm going to start with, you know, if I've got some soils that are a little bit lighter, tougher in terms of its drought resilience, I'm going all native mix, big blue Indian side oats, grama, throw in some western slender wheatgrass, green needlegrass, and then get a bunch of forbs and flowers in there, purple prairie clover, lead plant, coneflowers. I mean, you know, you just that beautiful diverse mix of warm, cool season grasses and forbs is going there. And that's like my insurance policy on the farm as far as consistent grazing year over year. The cows do well on it. Like that's the bread and butter. Okay. So that's like my base grazing acres. And I guess, you know, to tie in the annual side, I like to use annual grazing systems in conjunction with harvested annual forages. So, let's focus on the cattle, and I would probably still do some cattle and sheep just because I get to choose. And so that's how I'd do it. Sure. And, but I'd also probably keep my calves if I had that amount of grazing acres, and I'd run them as stockers, right? Add some value there in the spring. And so, there is how I would do it is I would have some corn silage or sorghum silage on hand, right? And I'd use those acres after it's harvested to stick in some winter annual for grazing with my stockers or to calve on, depending on what the spring gave me. And so I'd use like winter rye or winter triticale to then come to first in the spring. And I like it to graze on just because we can spread things out. It's a green mat of growing vegetation that's healthy, and I'm not, you know, tying all up or putting everything up in a lot, and I get things out on the field, right? Mm-hmm. So that's how I'm using those harvested acres for silage to then come back to with that winter annual. After that, I graze that. I'm going back to something with like a summer annual grazing system that I then can use for either an insurance grazing area for my cow calf, or I'm moving my stockers back onto that. And so that's usually going to be like end of June, first part of July. You know, it's some sorghum standgrass, millet, sunflowers, brassicas of turnips, radishes. And that'll probably give me like at least a twice through grazing system. I can come through it once, then go back to my pasture, then come back onto that in the fall.
Sure.
There too, I'd still have some sort of hay crop mix in here on those acres too. Especially if I'm still living where I'm living, we've got to have some feedstuffs on hand all the time, right? Sure. To feed through.
Yeah.
And so I like perennial grass to have that, once again, that consistency of forage. You know what's going to be there. I don't have to rely on a rain to get it going in the spring, and I don't have to rely on great weather to keep that annual going. So I'd do something where we've got mostly grass, but just a little bit of alfalfa. Nothing's more persistent than alfalfa in the upper Midwest. And so having something that's got, you know, like a 40% alfalfa with some meadow brome, forage fescue, wheatgrass, orchard grass, timothy, I like those blends where it's mostly grass, but just a little bit of alfalfa there too. I like to use those for grazing in the fall. When we can tie everything together, grazing, taking pressure off of our perennial grass, but coming onto the annuals, that's good for just that rest period of those perennials, especially on those natives too. So I like to be able to make sure that we're tying it all together, still using it for grazing if we need to in the year. We talk about that insurance of perennials is important, but the production of harvestability of annuals and the yield potential is still much higher than those perennials.
Mm-hmm. So, well, Jared, did you have anything you want to add or your scenario? And then maybe we'll dive into some of the questions that I've got on these.
Yeah. So Justin gave me the advanced advantage as he was talking to actually, right? So I'm thinking of this as like an Eastern South Dakota play. And I'm thinking the way you ask the question, the way I'm going to answer is to say, you told me I have to make a living, right? And I can only do it through grazing, and I only have 500 acres. And I'm thinking about the lay of the land, the types of areas that I have, right? So this is what I got to do. Okay. So in addition to a whole bunch of different kinds of programs, you know, including NRCS and AgSpire and whatever, that I'm going to overlay on top of this to take advantage of the massive positive thing I'm doing to soil health by incorporating the system, that's going to be an income source that I'm probably not going to, you know, refer to right now, but it's going to be meaningful. It's going to be there. So I'm going to say that I'm going to plant about half of this land, back to what Justin said, to that diverse native perennial mix. It's going to take a little while to establish, but it's not going to be consistent. It's going to be almost all the upland, poorly drained type areas is where I want to go to. So hilltops and slopes and all that kind of stuff. That's where my upland is going to be. That's going to go to half the acres. But another 20% of the acres are going to go to this improved, like Justin was talking about, improved perennials, right? So alfalfa mixes like the Stockman or some straight grasses, all my lowlands and waterways, even in the pastures I'm planting by the natives. I'm going to plant creeping meadow foxtail I'm going to plant Garrison. I'm going to plant some things like that in those waterways instead of natives, because I just like them better than the native wetland grasses. Garrison is a much better palatable, you know, grass than prairie court grass. No offense, native wetland grasses, but you're weak. You're very weak. Plant it all back that way. So there's going to be 100 acres. It's going to be a little bit like the grass waterways, even within my pasture. So I'm going to plant my grass waterways and my pasture planting different than the uplands, which is not something that's typical, but I think it really, really does work well. And the nice thing about Garrison is that it's not going to creep back up in the side hills. It's not like a brome grass where I put down there that's eventually just going to take over and get everywhere. Right at the water table line where it can't support it, the Garrison stops and it stays the same line like year after year after year after year. So it's like invasive where you want it and non-invasive where you don't to stop it. And then I'm going to keep 150 acres in the annual system, and I'm going to go back and forth on those 75 acre fields in some type of rotation, but it's basically going to be in oats, grazing, cover crop and corn, you know, triticale rye mix, right? It's going to be like I have a four crops, 3 years type rotation that goes through that system every time. That's going to give me, I think, the stocking rate to run about 65, if I'm doing some rotating, about 65 to 70 cow-calf pairs with enough other forage, like on the grazing cropland and stuff, to run 100 head of sheep, 100 head of ewes, and the replacement heifers I need, right? So now I have kind of an intact system of 100, you know, lambed out ewes and 60 to 65 lambed out cows every year to generate my income.
Cool. I like the, you guys took it way even farther than I was expecting, talking about uplands, lowlands, waterways, how you're going to manage these different landscapes. So I appreciate that. That's awesome. One of the questions that, big questions that I had right off the bat, because I don't have any experience with them out here, but both of you are pretty intentional about wanting natives in your system. And maybe just start off with why, what's the importance of them? We looked at it at one point and in our context over in Southeast Minnesota and kind of leaned against them ultimately because of establishment time frame and challenges and things, but it was pretty important to both of you, it sounds like, to have natives over more of a perennial base of improved forage species. Can you talk about why that's so important?
Well, I think if you are intensively grazing, there's nothing more persistent than like these introduced species. And so your yield and production would be higher in that scenario. If you're going to slow down your intensity as far as management and moves, and you want a hardier, more resilient system, then the natives are the answer. But yeah, they're going to take a full year to establish. And you don't have that, you don't have the persistence of regrowth that you would in an introduced management, system, like with bromes, orchard fescues type of video.
Yeah. Same. I think it's just, it's about the resilience and about the consistency in tougher times and environmental variability for us that gets me, you know, kind of excited about using that system. Much, much deeper root system. Taking advantage of water table, you know, water levels that you can't with shallower rooted introduced species. And that's kind of what gets me excited.
And it might be too, we just came off of two really dry years and they worked, right? And if you're in Eastern Minnesota and a little bit higher rainfall area, your production will be much higher with those introduced species.
So I guess to clarify then, in our environment, would you not maybe do as much natives in a more higher moisture environment?
No, I would say it depends on your management style.
Okay.
You know, like if I was, here we go back to like, what do you really want to get out of it? If you want to plant this pristine pasture and let your cows on it and just let them be out there for the year, I'd do it all native pasture.
Yeah. Here's the question, Jared, if you walked away from the farm and time traveled and came back 100 years later and nobody touched anything, and you went back to your fields and your pastures, would they be grass or trees?
Would they be trees by then, the succession? They'd be largely, yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
Okay. Then I think I wouldn't focus on native grasses. If that happened where I live, we'd lose all our trees. The shelter belts would die. There'd be some cottonwoods left of the lowlands. But we never expend time on woody overgrowth in our pastures at all. It's non-factor. Sure. Can't get trees to grow there. We have to really, really work at it and baby them for the first 5 to 8 years of life. And so the C4 grass, like big blue sand grass, that's the trees of the plants, right? That's what wants to be there. So in your situation, I don't know if that I would force a C4, you know, native grass in that situation, because that's actually not the highest level. It'll go one higher of succession. Here, this is the highest succession level that you can get from a natural habitat.
Interesting. Okay, cool. Yeah, I like that. That's it's intriguing. Yeah, we looked at it pretty seriously for a while, and this is maybe a myth you can dispel, because we had hoped that we love sorghum sedan grass, this warm season annual that can balance our forage supply, because we have obviously the spring flush, the summer slump, and a little bit of a bump in the fall. And how can we balance our forage chain so we have forage throughout the year? We thought some warm season natives might do that. What we maybe also kind of learned is that maybe isn't quite the case, that you can't just let it stockpile till July and August and it'll be great quality and, you know, this perfect late summer grazing to balance while your cool seasons rebuild. Is that a true or false statement then?
I think it's true. I think you can just, you're more productive, and so you force them into it. My thought process is that there's going to be a fair amount of selectivity. We're not going to, the way that I'm thinking about managing, unless I did a lot differently, would not be as intense in the way that you're doing it. And what you're doing is right. But so I want the cattle to be a little bit more selective. And by the time that we get out there in midsummer, we want them to be able to actually, you know, pick around a little bit, you know, leave a lot of biomass, trample biomass, and, you know, focus on lactation and gain. That's just it's my standpoint, but it's, what we can't have is a lack of like June rain, so we don't get a flush of the improved stuff, and then it never comes on because we get summer heat, and then we stock. But we're in a 22-inch rainfall environment, right? You're in a 42.
Sure.
38, yeah. Whatever, you know.
36, yeah, right. More, significantly more. Yes.
Cool. More and better. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Awesome. Oh, cool. The other question, or go ahead, Justin or no, Jared.
I have a native bias too. It's part of my winning, right? It's something I really enjoy. Yeah. So,
well, that's a good point too, because it's like I've talked to a lot of people, same thing, where they just have this desire to see it back in as close to as native prairies as what it maybe once was or something. And yeah, if that's a goal of yours, then there's ways to make that successful as well. Do you have any idea how much roughly production in terms of dry matter you might see in natives versus, and I keep saying improved, you're using introduced, probably a better term, well, because I know those species aren't always improved. They've given us our challenges too, but
I think improved is probably the better word, because that's what gives it its persistence and yield and quality advantages. They've been bred to continue to regrow after each grazing or cutting. And so there too, I think if you were to just let those species grow, orchard fescue brome next to Indian big blue and side oats, obviously those natives are going to be taller, higher yielding in a one cut system. Mm. But if you're coming through them and you're grazing it four times in a year, the persistence of these improved grasses are going to gain you more yield.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So then my next question for you, again, you're getting started here, and I guess I didn't stipulate that. But to have a perennial system versus an annual system is going to require either some additional expense in hiring the seeding done, certainly the seed cost annually, year over year, and or you have to have some overhead and tied up in seeding equipment or planting equipment for these annuals versus the perennials year after year. Those annuals are going to be more productive. They're going to have some more costs associated with it. You seem to feel those annuals justify the expense in terms of through the additional production and the benefits probably of balancing that forage supply.
I would say that, you know, in all situations, like the, given the scale of this, you know, size footprint and operation, it's not small, it's acres, but it's not huge, that almost every piece of machinery is going to be a trade, right? Like a neighbor co-investment or whatever else, you know, it's like, hey, I've got a neighbor that needs help with haying, you know, like he has to put up his road ditches, whatever, doesn't want to do it. So I'm going to use his equipment. I'm going to do all this stuff for him. I'm going to use it at my place for this, right? Or if I do buy a drill here, which I'm going to need, whether I'm doing perennials, this, I'm going to make sure that I do custom work, you know, both spring and fall for everybody else around there to make sure that the cash flows for me. Otherwise I'm going to rent or borrow. So I guess I envision, and then in this scenario in my mind, there's opportunities for that. If you said that there was no opportunities, I'm literally on an island, right, in the Pacific Ocean off the coast of Alaska, no sharing of things like that, then I'm like, yeah, we better simplify this. Let's just get everything seeded down to grass, get some poly wire, super simple. But given the fact that I see reasonable trades with neighbors and value opportunities, I'm going to say I'm okay with still the split.
And when I think on perennials and cool season perennials, we're oftentimes making hay on some of that excess spring flush that we have anyway. So you're kind of trading custom haying versus custom seeding or some sort of, you know, there's going to be some equipment involvement anywhere, or you're going to have a bunch of mature rank forage or have to really some pretty intense management to keep on top of that spring flush.
My biggest thing is that and maybe you can achieve it in a higher rainfall environment with a late flush on your improved stuff, is that I don't want to give up crop residue and cover crop grazing that happens in, you know, mid-October through mid-January in my part of the world by, you know, trying to like maintain X amount of my grass, you know, as winter grazing. That's my big thing. I don't want to give up.
Yeah.
Why sure. I still have.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that makes sense. Yeah. Justin, anything? JW?
The flexibility of those acres with the annuals probably it gives you a bit more freedom to change your mind on what your plan is going to be from year to year. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, coming in and out of even a commodity might be a bigger benefit to you versus tying it up into a perennial. If something changes with market dynamics and,
yeah,
you know, it can be farmed too.
Well, that's an interesting point because we had some of our very best, we raised some organic crops as well. And some of our best corn, we thought we were getting more turkey manure, we didn't. So it was ground that had come out of a cover crop and put into corn with no fertilizer in a drought year. It was some of our best yielding weed-free corn.
Wow.
It was remarkable compared to a lot of our, in the organic system, our conventional stuff blew that out of the water for sure. But from organic stuff, even the stuff that was fertilizer, coming out of covers. So that is true. There's one thing I like about an annual system as opposed to a perennial system year over year is, say corn goes to $7 next fall. You know, it hurts a lot more to take corn or take pasture out of, you know, perennial pasture,
yeah,
and rip it up or spray it out and plant, mm-hmm, it to corn than it does to just say, oh, I'll just buy a little more feed with my $7 corn and put that sorghum ground into a corn this year or something like that.
So yep.
There's some truth to some flexibility in your enterprise mix too.
Somebody's got to be able to flex to take advantage of the market opportunities. If not, like there's no like the market whatsoever on what acres can do, then that's a pretty boring market, right? If we're going to have 92.2 million acres of corn, whether it's worth $1.50 or $7.50, then you can't change it, right? Someone's got to be able to flock.
Yeah. Well, I suppose every time prices get high, usually it's just permanent pasture that shouldn't be in crops that's coming out, getting ripped up and put back into corn. It'd be nice if it wasn't maybe that. Yeah.
Yep.
How much more is there still ground out there that, like, every time, like 2013, I remember the conversation, there's all this ground that shouldn't be going into crops that's, it's been in pasture and it's going to be put into corn now. And then I thought that had to be all of it. And then 2021 to there's all this ground that's been pasture that shouldn't be in crops. So they're pulling it out. Is there still more out there then?
Millions of acres.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah. That can be farmed. Yeah.
Well, to the degree, like to the same degree that many acres today are being farmed.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. With the price, yes, there's millions more acres. I mean, tens of millions of PB with you. I mean, I remember taking pictures kind of in the Yellow River Valley up in the Xi'an province, or up in Gansu province next to Xi'an, where the terracotta soldiers are in China. And we were looking at steep hillsides that were like the equivalent of like the Missouri River breaks that were unirrigated, terraced, like small, like 20-foot wide paths. And they were growing 12 bushel wheat on these fields. And it was like if you terraced all of Western South Dakota in order to make a small path there that you could grow wheat, and their yields were 12 to 15 bushels. Okay. And I was like looking at that and I was like, oh, I mean, our definition of unfarmable here because of slopes and erosion is nothing compared to the slope that we see in the lowest hills in Iowa, or, you know, Southern Iowa, Northern Missouri, even Northeast Nebraska, the hillsides of their farm. We'd say, oh, that's way too hilly to farm. It's not too rocky. Just go pick them, no-till it, whatever. I mean, I don't know that there's really a very firm, like, stop to how far you farm if you wanted to farm at all.
Yeah.
When you look at other places.
I don't know if you guys have found the challenge of doing this podcast thing. I don't know how long we want to go. My challenge has been, you piqued my curiosity with a whole nother line of questioning we could talk for another hour on.
I tell people all the time, like, feeder cap demand is the only thing stopping this thing from eroding further. So I actually almost no start time, so this is probably not going to happen. But if someone's listening for a graduate level study, or wanting to go to grad school and wanting to study like economics and impact, I think it would be really interesting to overlay the WWF plow print, which they've been running for 15 or 20 years now. So they've got this 20-year record of how much grass is coming out of grass in the Northern Plains, especially. And then they'll list that year by year based on satellite imagery. I think it's probably 15 or 20 years back. To overlay that with cow-calf herd profitability, they want to like compare it to like CRP releases and that kind of stuff. But like, no, go back to cow-calf profitability based on cattle facts and see where that tail is, to see, is there a direct correlation to ensuing loss of grasslands after 2 to 3 consecutive years of low cow-calf profitability? And I think there is, based what we've seen. So,
wow. Yeah.
Somebody wants to do that analysis, get a hold of us. It'd be fun to do.
It would be very interesting to see.
Quant Division of Eggspire can do that.
Perfect. Yeah.
This is a great, this is also, I think, the long one that we've ran too. So it's been fun to do it together. Appreciate it.
Yeah. No, absolutely. Well, I so appreciate it, guys. Yeah. This is awesome. And for folks who listening on this, they definitely got to tune into the Roots and Ruminants podcast. These guys are awesome. They get on great guests every week. And you've already heard it. They're great at bouncing off each other. Really fun conversation. Thanks, guys.
If you're listening to Roots and Ruminants, you probably have already, but if you haven't already, check out Jared Ruben Lumen and Herd Quitter podcast.
Well, we hope you enjoyed another episode of the Roots and Ruminants podcast. Let us know what you thought of it. You can follow us on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, all those social media things. And, if you ever have any questions, just give us a call. We've got a toll-free number here at 888-498-7333. Be glad to hear from you. Thank you.